Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders.
All right, Watto. I hate how much I like this one. What do you call an acid with a bad attitude?
I don't know.
Amino acid.
All right, Paul, I have a different one. Paul, throwing acid is wrong in some people's eyes.
All right, a little darker than I would have expected, but all right.
Yeah, I thought it was okay. All right, thanks to once again, I got to just say punstoppable.com. I love that site. It's great.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Paul, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, Matt. I always like when you put a little English on my first name, so thanks for that.
You're welcome. And tonight we have a great guest, Dr. Tim Yao. And Paul, we talk about metabolic acidosis in CKD. This is part of our annual NEF Madness participation. Once again, there's a pod crawl going on, and our good friend Cyrus Askin, who now has a podcast, he's doing metabolic acidosis in critical care, and we're doing metabolic acidosis just for, you know, the internist. We're not critical care intensivists, so we're staying out of the ICU for this discussion and more like your primary care management of CKD metabolic acidosis. Paul, before I read our guest bio, would you remind the audience, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure. Happy to, as always, Matt. As a reminder, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And as you alluded to, we are joined by Dr. Tim Yao, who, Matt, you will now tell us all about.
Our guest, Dr. Timothy Yao, is an associate professor of medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He has received 7 Distinguished Service Teaching Awards and was named the winner of the American Society in Nephrology Innovations in Kidney Education Contest for a web-based video curriculum to provide real-time nephrology education. Nationally, he has served as the social media editor for the American Journal of Kidney Disease and is faculty for the Nephrology Social Media Collective. And it's not hard to understand how he's accomplished all these things after hearing him in this interview. He does a great job, and we're happy for you to hear it. Before we get to it, a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All right, Tim, we've been, I guess, virtual friends for a while. I think you and Paul have met each other in real life, but now the audience is meeting you for the first time. So share with them a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks for having me on. Hobby or interest outside of medicine. The two that I always think about are music. I play a lot of different instruments. Grew up playing piano, shifted to guitar in high school, and have played a lot of different stringed instruments over the years. Over the last 10 years, I've mostly played traditional Irish music, which is totally random. And if you walk into an Irish bar and you see a guy like me, for those of you listening on the pod, tall Asian guy, it's not usually what you expect. But that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years with music. And then I play a lot of video games too, even though I'm in my mid-40s. Such is life.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Video games would destroy my life if I played them. I can't. Paul, you saw what happened to me when I played Zelda. So I had to, I'm back in retirement. But Paul, what are you playing now?
Thanks for asking, Matt. I've regressed to Skyrim, which is what happens when I'm like in an emotionally dicey place. I go back to my comfort game. But I've been going back to the oldies but goodies.
Yeah, for me, the comfort game is like pure torture and like Dark Souls. So it's not for everyone, but I just am a sadist, I guess.
Yeah, no, when you already feel like a failure, it's like just a little insult to injury. That's a great plan. So I guess my follow-up question for you, in addition to the what are you playing right now, is give me some new music. What's the last like album that you've actually bought? Like, I feel like I'm so used to like downloading singles, but what's the last like full record that you got that you can recommend?
Great question. I would say, so I don't buy any music anymore, but the last album I downloaded from Apple was probably the Boy Genius album.
Oh, sure.
Which they had only released an EP prior. I'm a big Phoebe Bridgers fan. And so I think she's incredible and that group is incredible.
Yeah, I was peripherally aware of them and then saw them on Saturday Night Live. And I was like, oh my. Like now I see what everyone's talking about. Like very super exciting. Belongs in everyone's top 10 list. Yeah, great recommendation.
Well, we're going to get to a case in a second, but give us another recommendation or of a kind, if you will. What is some good advice or some really meaningful feedback that you've received at some point in your career?
So I do a lot of mentoring work with medical students and some advice that I got and have tried to live by. And, you know, when I have not lived by it, I have found that I'm not doing quite as well as I should have been. It was just to keep an open mind as you go through things. I remember, for example, like being told, like, keep an open mind in med school. And, you know, I remember doing my surgery clerkship and immediately despising it and taking it off the list. But it's not that I would have gone into surgery. It's just that if I had kept the open mind, I would have enjoyed the clerkship so much more. And I feel like when I got to like the OB clerkship, I kind of had this reframing of like, okay, this is the only time I'm ever going to deliver babies in my life. I might as well enjoy it. And in retrospect, that was just such a better way to approach things. And so that's usually the advice that I give to people, especially young trainees, and still try to live by that too.
Yeah, that's just, I mean, that's a great way to get through, I guess, med school and any kind of training where you're just like, all right, I'm just going to throw myself into this learning about this topic because I'm being forced to learn about it. So that's good advice. I like it. Thank you. Well, we have a case for you tonight, and this is part of the Neff Madness pod crawl, which we've been in. And this year, you're also doing one with Critical Care Time, right? Kind of to complement this one from that's the critical care side of metabolic acidosis, which, Paul, I don't feel like me and you are qualified for critical care management of metabolic acidosis. Not anymore, anyway.
Well, maybe after this episode, but yeah, not presently.
Well, Paul, we're not going to be talking about critical care patients. This is more of an outpatient, you know, chronic CKD management of metabolic acidosis. That's what we're shooting for here. And probably throw in some just general CKD pearls as well. So let's start off. Paul, would you read a case here? And I believe our patient is Mrs. T, not to be confused with Mr. T.
All right, we're going to talk about Mrs. T, a 62-year-old female. She has a history of type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and CKD4 with mild albuminuria. Her baseline creatinine is around 2.4. She's in the primary care office to follow up on lab results. Her blood pressure has been in the 120s to 130s, over 70s to 80s. Typically, she's on valsartan amlodipine combination because we are very good doctors. 160 milligrams of valsartan, 5 milligrams of amlodipine. She takes metformin XR 750 twice daily, and we should probably think about that. Her lab shown A1C of 7.7%. Her BUN is 25. Her potassium is 4.9. Creatinine is 2.4 with an EGFR less than 30 by CKD Epi 2021 with an albumin creatinine ratio of 75. Sodium 139, chloride 107, serum bicarb 19, albumin of 4 with an anion gap of 13. Mrs. T noticed her bicarbonate was in the red zone when reviewing her labs and wants to know what the significance of this is. This is our metabolic acidosis and CKD episode. So could you just walk us through your sort of initial general approach to patients like Mrs. T, and then we can sort of delve into how you manage her and sort of how you have this conversation with her?
Yeah, sure. So it's a pretty standard CKD case. We see a lot of these, and I think there are a couple things to point out. One is that her GFR is less than 30. So we're in CKD stage 4, which is pretty advanced. And this is the range at which we would typically see metabolic acidosis. So when you look at patients with CKD and metabolic acidosis, it's about 15 to 20% of patients. But as your GFR declines, that incidence goes up. So if you had said this patient has a creatinine of 1.3 and their CKD was only in the maybe 2 to 3 range, it would be unusual for me to see this degree of acidosis and would make me think of other acid-based disturbances like RTAs and such. But for the sake of this example, we're in advanced CKD. This degree of metabolic acidosis is not that unusual. I think the second thing to bring up is that we'll be talking a lot about metabolic acidosis, bicarb, whether to give it, and so forth. But it sounds almost bad to say this at the beginning of the episode, but in the grand scheme of like CKD management, dealing with metabolic acidosis is not as important as dealing with, you know, are they on an ACE and an ARB? Are we optimizing their blood pressure? Are we dealing with their sugars and so forth? So even though we're talking about a topic, metabolic acidosis, that I think is important, I would consider like ACEs, ARBs, blood pressure control, kind of in the S tier interventions for CKD management. And I would think of addressing the acidosis more kind of in the B tier level of significance. So not as important. I think the third thing that I want to point out about the case is that in nephrology, like trends matter a lot more than single numbers. So I appreciate you giving me the information in the case, but I think looking at the trend in bicarbonate is really helpful. So if her bicarbonate's, like you mentioned, 19 now, if she had always been prior to this kind of in the 20s, then I probably wouldn't worry about it too much. And I'd say, okay, it's just a one-off. But if she's consistently kind of, you know, in the 16 to 19 range, then I would prioritize kind of the discussion more. I think it's important to remember that bicarbonate, just like potassium or all these other things on the chemistry panel, are variables that, you know, are one-time measurements. They're continuous variables. So it might be 21 one day and then drop down a bit more depending on, you know, the patient's dietary intake over the last week.
Yeah, that's good. I like the framing of it as like, you know, this is a topic we absolutely pay attention to, even as general internists, because one of Paul's jokes, you know, this is like one of those questions they always like to ask on boards, like when, at what level should you start bicarb, which I think that's part of what makes this an interesting topic, because we'll talk about in a little while that how that might be changing. But it's helpful to frame it as like, well, blood pressure control is probably a more important thing. And as internists, you know, we're definitely capable of managing some blood pressure. What do you think about her overall medications, amlodipine, valsartan, metformin with this CKD4? What do you think about that?
It seems like there's pretty good, you know, blood pressure looks good. You know, she's on a pretty decent dose of an ARB. You know, Paul correctly mentioned she's on metformin, which it's not like definitely need to stop this, but at a GFR less than 30, you have to be a little bit careful of it. You know, I'm looking at the A1C of 7.7, and we could do a little bit better than that. So there are some things that we could optimize, the metabolic acidosis being one of the many aspects of the CKD management that we can talk about.
This episode is brought to you by Rocket Money. Personally, I love to have control of my finances. I like to know where my money's going, and I don't like to pay for things that are not useful to me, and that's why I love Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. An audience, who doesn't want more savings? Who doesn't want to save more money over time so you can eventually retire someday and stop working so hard? I know I do. Well, Rocket Money can help you cancel subscriptions that you've probably forgotten about, and with just a few taps, you can get rid of them. You don't even have to call and wait online with customer service. They also have a dashboard, which I love, that can show you your monthly spending, how it compared to the previous month. Rocket Money will also help negotiate to lower your bills by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and they will take care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/curb. That's rocketmoney.com/curb. rocketmoney.com/curb. Yeah, and I think if I'm being honest, Paul, the metformin is left in there probably because initially I was going to have this be a CKD3 case, and the metformin wouldn't have been as big of a dicey issue. So, because a lot of people
have to admit that, Matt, this is a very naturalistic case. How often do we start someone with metformin and they're on in perpetuity as their kidney function just kind of quietly declines? So no need to pull the curtain back for the audience to see. We're geniuses, and that's all you need to know.
I will say what I would do in real life, Tim, here, like not being a nephrologist, I would be like, all right, the EGFR is now less than 30. They're on metformin. Even though they seem stable and they're not acutely ill, like if they became acutely ill, then maybe that could be like, yeah, you know, make them even more ill than they would have been. So probably I would stop it and be talking to them about different medications for it, just because I'm a wimp about that. I don't want
to deal with a potential lactic acidosis.
Yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
There's no bigger coward than me. We've established that. Yeah.
Okay. So, so let's talk about like, why might we care about metabolic acidosis though? You know, even if it's not the most important factor of managing their CKD, like why might we care about it? What consequences have been linked to it?
So I think before we talk about the consequences, let's just briefly think about why metabolic acidosis occurs in CKD in the first place, which is that your kidneys are one of the organs along with your lungs that manage acid-base homeostasis. I guess you could include the bones in there too, because they're a big buffer. But as far as actually adapting to the acid load, it's kind of the kidneys and the lungs. And, you know, the lungs, you know, are constantly breathing out CO2, huge amounts of it every day. But there is some acid that's being accumulated, which can't be excreted in the form of carbon dioxide. And so this is mostly what we call organic acid production, which comes from cellular metabolism, but also a big part of that acid that can't be excreted by the lungs is dietary. And a lot of that is metabolism products from animal proteins, for example, get metabolized to sulfuric acid. So that needs to be buffered and needs to be reclaimed by the kidney. When we think about the kidneys and acid loads and so forth, we have to think about our diet, which is kind of creating acid and potentially creating base too. I think we'll get into this when we talk about some of the dietary interventions. But with healthy kidneys, you know, any variability in this net acid production is balanced by excreting those excess protons as ammonium and generating new bicarbonate. So if your kidney function declines and your GFR declines, you have lower number of nephrons in general, the kidney's ability to manage that net acid load becomes restricted and you develop metabolic acidosis. It's usually not that severe, kind of like in this case. Mm-hmm. Going back to the other question of what are the consequences of this, you know, as your bicarbonate drops and acidosis occurs, it leads to a lot of different upregulations of things like angiotensin II, aldosterone, endothelin. All of those together accelerate kidney fibrosis, GFR loss, and so forth. So there's definitely some retrospective data to support that. But there are also other effects of chronic metabolic acidosis, like effects on muscle, decreasing muscle mass, strength, affecting bones. And a lot of these associations were also demonstrated in a lot of animal models. A little bit harder to tease out in actual human trials, though.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like, to some extent, this is sort of a self-perpetuating cycle of if you have chronic kidney disease, which leads to chronic metabolic acidosis, which in turn leads to progression of chronic kidney disease and sort of so forth and so on, which fits some of the things that we'll talk about later on.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and so I mentioned like some of the retrospective data. Like, so, you know, not looking at like prospective RCTs, but there were CKD cohorts where you would categorize patients into either like low bicarb, low normal, normal. And it showed that the low bicarb groups, you know, accelerated much faster towards renal events, low bicarb a little bit faster compared to the normal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So far we've talked about, you know, decreased muscle mass, maybe fibrosis of the kidney, progression of CKD, and not good for the bones. And then what about the cardiovascular events and outcomes?
Yeah, so there have been some studies looking at, you know, major adverse cardiovascular events. There have even been some trials looking at, you know, harder outcomes like mortality, but they haven't been consistently demonstrated in repeated trials. I think when we get to the history of, you know, sodium bicarb, how did it come to be, we'll talk about some of these early trials, which were really encouraging and maybe led to some aggressive guidelines. And as we'll talk about, were not as easy to reproduce those benefits.
Well, why don't we get to the next part of the case? And I think we had a medical student in this case. Should we keep his name as Jake Paul, or should we change it to Paul? I feel like this is something you would do, Paul, as a medical student.
No, it's very kind, except the kidneys were a black box for me when I was in medical school, so I'm not sure I'd be the one making the suggestion, but we can let's leave it to Jake.
Okay.
So we're referring to Jake, an enterprising young medical student who's shadowing you, Tim, in clinic. Kind of a gunner attitude, it feels like. So Jake had a U-World question suggesting that metabolic acidosis should be treated with bicarb replacement. So Jake is asking you, should this patient be on bicarb? And they're making the recommendation. So can you, you've alluded to this a little bit, but can you sort of talk us through some of the history as to why we're doing this and why we might consider it?
Yeah. So first off, love having enterprising medical students in clinic with me because they always ask these hard questions, even if they're gunning a little bit. They have that that glint of curiosity or whatever it may be that tends to just slowly fade with more rigorous training. So talking about kind of like, you know, giving bicarbonate for metabolic acidosis, it makes sense from a basic chemistry standpoint, right? So one thing that I'm always reminded of when I'm thinking about this topic was I teach a lot of acid-base physiology to medical students. And part of my rule is like, try to keep things as simple as possible. And so I have kids, and my six-year-old kid at the time asked me, Dad, what is an acid? And I had the hardest time trying to describe what an acid was to a six-year-old with no chemistry, right? I can talk about protons and all this stuff, and like to a six-year-old, that just means nothing. And I still haven't found a good way to explain what is an acid to a six-year-old. So open suggestions from you guys.
So I had an uncle who was a dentist. And at a young age, he found out I was going to be a doctor, and he was asking me about acid base. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And he's like, you know what a really strong acid is? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, it'll burn a hole in your hand. And I'm like, okay. And then he goes, you know what a really strong base is? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, it'll burn a hole in your hand. I'm like, oh, okay. So yeah. That stuck with me. I don't know if you want to scare your kid like that, but maybe yeah. you could think of a, you know, slightly similar application that's less terrifying.
Right.
But that kind of gave me the gist of it.
Yeah. I mean, I always think about kind of like the, you know, the vinegar and baking soda volcano, like from grade school or middle mm-hmm. school, you know? And so like, it really is just chemistry. You're neutralizing something, you're alkalinizing something. So I think when you think about like the origin of giving sodium bicarbonate or something like that, a base for an acidosis, this has been occurring for over 100 years. They were actually measuring pH, you know, probably in the early part of the 19th century and giving sodium bicarbonate to neutralize that excess acid. So I think one nice thing about this is that we're not talking about anything particularly novel here. But as far as like giving bicarbonate in real life, in clinical practice, you know, how we do it is we literally will give tablets of sodium bicarbonate, right? And so I think this is where one of our first like big teaching pearls come in. And you mentioned kind of that we aren't going to talk about critical care, but I'm just going to briefly talk about
sure.
an ICU patient, right? So like in an ICU or a code situation, like in the code cart, there's usually an amp of bicarbonate. Or you might give a bicarbonate drip, you know. So when you think about the amount of bicarbonate in that amp, it's 50 milliequivalents in 50 mLs. And so if you were to make a drip, for example, you would put three of those amps into D5W, and it would be 150 milliequivalents of sodium bicarbonate. So it's essentially an isotonic fluid, virtually the same as normal saline, except that bicarbonate is your anion instead of chloride. But when we talk about oral sodium bicarbonate repletion, all of a sudden we're not talking about amps, we're talking about 650 milligrams. And it's a completely different unit. And so you have to make this conversion from grams to milliequivalents. And so you can do some fancy math with the molecular weight of bicarbonate and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, that 650 milligram tablet is just under 8 milliequivalents of sodium bicarbonate. So it's much less. I usually just recommend to students or residents that they don't worry about the math and they just remember that like this tablet that you're giving, which is 650 milligrams, is about 8 milliequivalents, whereas that drip that they're giving is 150 milliequivalents. So the big point is that it's much less than the IV formulation if you're giving it orally.
And what about, do you have a baking soda conversion for the, if you want to go old school and just take baking soda, how much is
yes.
in
a... Yeah. So this occurs sometimes in clinical practice when you have patients who have trouble swallowing the pills because the pills are pretty large. Baking soda will still have the same adverse effects, which are mostly GI related. It's like nausea and feeling full and belching. Baking soda won't alleviate that problem, but for patients who have difficulty kind of swallowing these pills, and usually you're giving like at least 2 to 4 of these a day, you can just replete with kind of regular baking soda, which you can buy in the store, which is just 100% sodium bicarbonate. And the conversion to a 650 milligram tablet would be give 1/8 of a teaspoon. And so I usually recommend they just take about 1/4 teaspoon mixed in with a little bit of water twice a day if I'm repleting it with baking soda.
Yeah, I guess you could get into some big trouble if you're taking like full tablespoons of baking soda.
It's interesting because we always think about baking soda as, you know, simply something that sits in your refrigerator and helps with odor. I don't know if it actually does, but that's what it's doing in my refrigerator. But if you look at the back, it has like detailed instructions of how to take it. And it says to be used for heartburn or dyspepsia or indigestion. And what they actually say on the back, or at least the box that I looked at, was to take 1/4 teaspoon as needed for indigestion up to 7 times a day. I was like, that's a lot of bicarbonate.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of bicarb. Okay.
Probably also see a doctor if you're taking sodium bicarbonate 7 times a day for indigestion. There's something probably not great going on.
Yeah, there is that warning too. There is that warning in the back of the box as well.
So, and you mentioned that some people have side effects of like nausea, fullness, belching from the bicarb. You mentioned to me lemon juice when we were talking the other day. I'm not really familiar with that as a treatment for this.
Yeah, so lemon juice is pretty cool because it has potassium citrate. Now, citrate is converted to bicarbonate in the body, actually in a 3-to-1 ratio. So for every milliequivalent of citrate that you intake, you'll generate 3 milliequivalents of bicarbonate. So lemon juice also has essentially alkali in it. The problem with it, and we'll kind of get into this when we talk about the dietary stuff, it also has the potassium in it. And so people with CKD usually are told not to take a lot of potassium. So I would say potassium citrate can be used if potassium is not an issue. In clinical nephrology, it's mostly relegated to the world of kidney stones.
Okay. Yeah, so you're not telling your patient, like Mrs. T here, to take a couple swigs of lemon juice every day.
It's not actually unreasonable because there's some benefits of, you know, high potassium intake for CKD, as crazy as that sounds. I think you guys even covered that in an old Neph Madness, like Curbsiders collab. So it's not like completely unreasonable, but it definitely goes against the grain and goes against kind of what most people think about when it comes to CKD management and potassium restriction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So we'll get to the food stuff in a bit. We talked about the bicarb replacement, and Joel was on the show, of course, Kidney Boy, our chief of nephrology, talking about how there was some mixed evidence on sodium bicarb for CKD, because what we're hoping to do, like we talked about, is sort of prevent this progression of CKD and by correcting the metabolic acidosis. So what's the latest on that?
Yeah. So first of all, I love Joel. I'm not trying to take his spot.
No one suggested Joel really
well. Joel, if you're listening, I love you, buddy. So it's really interesting kind of like how the guidelines have almost gone, I don't want to say full circle, but they've definitely kind of backtracked on kind of what they initially were talking about. So the original guidelines looking at metabolic acidosis back in 2012 recommended giving sodium bicarbonate to patients with CKD if their serum bicarbonate was less than 22. Now, that is really pretty much normal if you think about that. And there were some small early studies that were really encouraging where they would give bicarbonate to patients with CKD and mild metabolic acidosis. And they were showing some incredible outcomes like reductions in doubling of serum creatinine, hospital days, all these things.
It's like even some mortality benefit in some of the small studies, right?
Yeah, exactly. In the UBI trial, there was even a mortality benefit, right? So everyone was really excited about this. I want to say, you know, 15 years ago, then there was some more robust studies over the next several years, which really weren't able to reproduce those early benefits. And so there were studies that were looking at all sorts of things, GFR decline, but also even like muscle function, doing muscle biopsies, doing bone mineral density, doing physical strength testing to see if there was benefit of acidosis or correcting the acidosis with bicarbonate on any of these outcomes. And honestly, the results were like super variable. Some showed benefit, some didn't. If it did, it was marginal. Honestly, kind of looking at the breadth of metabolic acidosis literature over the last 15 years really reminds me as a nephrologist a lot of kind of like those, you know, the 10 years of contrast nephropathy and N-acetylcysteine,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, this is definitely a medicine we should be using. And then there was like a trial that was yes, no, maybe, yes, no, maybe, yes, no, maybe. And it really took like this massive RCT, like PRESERVE, to clear the deck on the topic and say, no, it's not useful. So I don't think there is a massive RCT on sodium bicarbonate coming. I think the evidence over the last years have showed us a couple interesting things too, which are that there are some downsides of giving sodium bicarbonate, right? So it's sodium. There's that concern for volume retention and higher blood pressure. What's interesting is in the RCTs, there really wasn't a difference in blood pressure when you compared bicarbonate to placebo in almost all of the groups. Mm. One interesting downside, which I really didn't know about that much until kind of researching this topic, was there was a trial called BACE, which was looking at the safety and tolerability of various doses of sodium bicarbonate, like to give, one tab BID versus two tabs BID versus three tabs, how much should you give? And they showed that the more alkali therapy you gave, it was raising the urinary albumin to creatinine ratio, which is a hard outcome for nephrologists. That's probably related to the sodium load. I can't think of any other reason. Anyways, fast forward 10 years later to these new guidelines where the data hasn't been as reassuring. Rightfully so, I think that the guidelines are much more vague. So really now, instead of saying you should definitely treat with bicarbonate once the bicarb reaches 22 or less, they say you should, quote, consider using pharmacologic or dietary modifications, and they drop their threshold all the way down to 16. To be honest, I don't even know where that number and that cutoff came from, but it's a big difference, right? I see a lot of patients with CKD, and a lot of them have bicarbs in this 19, 20 range, which in the past definitely would have been treated. And now, based on the new guidelines, you're saying don't even mm-hmm. worry about that.
So if people want to look this up, I mean, of course, we'll put this in the show notes, but there's, as of February 2024, the guidelines for KDIGO 2023 are in draft. The CKD guidelines are in draft. So if you go to KDIGO's website today, they still have the 2012 guideline up there. And in section 3.4.1, they talked about the acidosis in the 2012 guideline. In section 3.9 in the 2023 guideline, that's where they talk about what Tim was just saying here. And practice point number two underneath the metabolic acidosis says, monitor to ensure correction of serum bicarb does not result in concentrations exceeding the upper limit of normal and does not adversely affect blood pressure, serum potassium, or fluid status. It was this thing that was like on all our board exams, and we kind of give bicarb around being like, oh yeah, there's no harm in this. Just give a bunch of bicarb. Make the numbers look nice. And now they're like, pump the brakes, like wait till it's really severe and then consider dietary or maybe some sodium bicarb. It's a big change.
Yeah. And the other thing about board exams is they usually lag behind the evidence by a fair number of years. So the correct answer on board exams for the next 5 years might still be to give bicarbonate. And then finally they'll come around to these guidelines. I think you brought up a really small esoteric point that I just want to point out. Like in the original 2012 guidelines, I think the recommendation was like a 2B or something.
It's a 2B. Yeah.
Is it a 2B? Okay. So it means there's a decent amount of evidence to support this. Mm-hmm. And now they relegate it to a practice point. So it's a big walk back. In addition to coming down from 22 to 16 and saying consider, they're also saying, like, this is not even a guideline anymore. This is just kind of a practice point.
Just going to muddy the waters now. Yeah.
Great. But what's exciting there is the dietary, you know, consider using dietary treatment, which is what we wanted to talk about a little bit here. So let's get back to Jake, because I want to stick it to Jake again. Actually, I love all our medical student listeners. Just think of like the person in your class you hate the most and just pretend that's who Jake is. Okay.
That's Jake. Yeah. Jake's the one who interrupts you on rounds. Yeah. We don't like Jake. But Jake is here. Jake has also read, because, you know, why wouldn't he? That patients with CKD should eat a diet low in animal proteins. Further, Mrs. T has had a borderline elevated potassium. So he speculates, because he's Jake, that she should limit her intake of fruits and vegetables since they are high in potassium. In fact, when asked, Mrs. T informs us that she cut back on fruits and green vegetables because her fear it might worsen her labs. So we've been sort of messing around the margins about sort of how to counsel patients about dietary ways to sort of address their metabolic acidosis. So where are we in terms of renal diet? What does the renal diet even look like now? What are we doing with proteins, and what are we doing with fruits and vegetables? Just talk us through it, because it feels like it's different than what I had learned.
Sure. So I think, you know, renal diet very broadly usually restricts sodium, potassium, and phosphorus. There's a lot of overlap with a lot of those things with protein. For example, it's very hard to restrict phosphorus and potassium without restricting certain types of protein as well. So I don't know that there is a specific recommendation on restricting animal protein, although that is really interesting when it comes to metabolic acidosis, because, you know, kind of what we talked about in the very beginning of the pod, which is that, you know, our net acid production, so much of it is driven by animal protein and what we eat. So animal proteins get converted to sulfuric acid, which need to be buffered and reclaimed. Plant proteins actually get converted for the most part to base. And so they actually help with, they're kind of like an intrinsic alkali, despite having levels of potassium in it. And so I think it becomes complicated because you're pushing one, you're pulling the other. But like anything, I want to say it really depends, right? So there are some CKD patients who we know are at risk or have demonstrated over the test of time that they are hyperkalemic and are constantly going to run their potassiums around 5.5 or whatever it may be. So in those patients, I'm not in favor of telling them to go crazy and eat a bunch of fruits and vegetables, bananas, oranges, et cetera. So the individual always matters. But if you look at some of the studies that compared patients with CKD4 on a high fruit and vegetable diet, they actually didn't have higher potassium levels. A lot of them actually had lower potassium levels. And when they would measure those patients' urinary potassium excretion, there was a much enhanced urinary potassium excretion in patients who were eating fruits and vegetables, and they were able to lower their serum potassium. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And this was Dr. Garaya has done a lot of that. And I believe we've mentioned her name on the show before. And it seemed like also the blood pressure was lower. They were like kind of looking at other markers like LDL cholesterol and things like that, that just like a lot of the cardiac profile was much more favorable treating with fruits and vegetables than with sodium bicarb or, I guess, usual care in some cases.
Yes, exactly. So Dr. Garaya is just a plug back in for NEF Medicine. He is our region expert for this region, for the metabolic acidosis region. She's down in Baylor in Texas and has done a lot of these studies kind of in randomizing patients with CKD4 and metabolic acidosis to either sodium bicarbonate or traditional alkali therapy or a diet high in fruits and vegetables. And it wasn't just simply telling them to do that. They've actually had a food bank directly deliver free of charge fruits and vegetables, you know, apples, apricots, oranges, peaches, pears, etc., to the door of the patient and say, use this however you want to for an entire year. And the study's outcome was looking at the GFR difference, of which there was none, but kind of like you mentioned, Matt, the fruits and vegetables group had lower blood pressure, they lost weight. Like I mentioned, they had lower potassiums throughout the year. And the only rationale that I can think of for that is that they had a significant reduction in dietary acid production due to the higher fruits and vegetables intake.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. And audience, I'm a huge fan of Freed because it can get you your life back. We're all spending too much time writing notes. Some of you are even doing that in your pajamas when you should be at home relaxing, hanging out with your families. Freed does your work for you. That's right. It listens, it prepares your notes, it writes patient instructions. The charting is done before you even walk out of the room, and it learns your style over time, just like a human scribe would. So it's not going to quit on you. It's going to keep working and get better for you over time as it learns your style. It's already loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It's HIPAA compliant. It takes about 30 seconds to learn. I know you all are tech savvy. You're podcast people. You can figure this out. It's easy to use. I've used it many times myself, and I really like it. It costs only $99 a month, and your time is worth way more than $99 a month. So try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. That's freed.ai. And use the code CURB50 for $50 off your first month. Yeah. And it's got to be good, you know, for just their overall metabolic health, or maybe there was weight loss and things like that as well that they could have been measured.
But I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So you said, but not a significant change in GFR between the two groups. There wasn't a change in the rate of decline or change in GFR. It was just the other sort of cardiometabolic outcomes seemed to be better. Is that?
Yeah, there was no change in GFR, which was the main outcome. Interestingly, the bicarb group had a higher bicarb. So it's like fixing the bicarb itself made the number look better. But at the end of the day, the outcomes like blood pressure, potassium, weight, and so forth were better in the fruits and vegetables group.
All right, Tim. So what in practicality might this look like when you're counseling a patient who comes to you with CKD and some chronic metabolic acidosis? Like what specific talking points do you make sure that you, I know it's got to be patient specific, but say their potassium is not raging out of control. So what does your usual counseling look like for patients in this particular situation?
Yeah. So I think, you know, this patient that you presented to me, first of all, seems to be doing fairly well despite her level of GFR. GFR is kind of in the 30 range. You know, that's a little bit scary. CKD4, you have to start thinking about dialysis, kidney transplant planning at least. But, you know, if this patient kind of noticed her own labs being abnormal, this patient is pretty self-motivated. I would say the biggest bang for the buck, which I kind of alluded to in the beginning, is that you should really focus on a lot of these other aspects of CKD management, like glycemic control and so forth, rather than, you know, fixating on the fact that the bicarbonate is 19. Certainly talking to her about dietary interventions, like eating more fruits and vegetables, especially because we're dealing with a normal potassium, right? If we had a patient, like I mentioned, like if they were always in the 5-5 range, I probably wouldn't be pushing it. But this patient has, you know, a high normal potassium. You have to remember that even at lower levels of GFR, patients can still adapt quite robustly. So if you gave this patient more potassium, it's not like the potassium is always going to go up. And I think Dr. Garaya's studies looking at that showed that, you know, urinary potassium excretion goes up and did not impact serum potassium. So eating more fruits and vegetables, I think reassuring this patient that this is something that we're going to watch, like we'll watch the potassium, we'll watch the bicarb. I would say that the current level of bicarbonate at 19 doesn't warrant super aggressive therapy. If it were to drop any further, you know, we always have a medicine like sodium bicarbonate we can use. But I think it's kind of, in some ways, these new guidelines and this lack of good evidence have given me and I think internists a lot of leeway in like not having to overtreat a disorder that previously was treated with a lot of pills.
Yeah, right. Because the pill burden wasn't nothing. Like that was like they were taking a lot of horse pills multiple times a day. Are you taking anyone off of sodium bicarb?
Yeah, I think the only people that I'm taking off sodium bicarb are the ones that I started initially. You know, so as the nephrologist, if I did start sodium bicarbonate and all of a sudden, like, you know, we're dealing with a bicarbonate that is in the 20 range, you know, I probably would stop it. I would say in general, even before these new guidelines drop, I was not a huge fan of giving a ton of bicarbonate to my patients with CKD4. And to be honest, very few of them were getting down to bicarbonates of 16. So I would say you can have a little bit more freedom if you want to deprescribe sodium bicarbonate. It certainly helps with the polypharmacy issue because, like you mentioned, it's a lot of pills.
So what about, you know, I remember this medicine, Vivarimer, that was sort of on the horizon. I think we talked a little bit about it with Joel. What's the latest on that? Are we going to see that come into the game here and be used for metabolic acidosis?
Unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to see it come into the game. So for a little background on Vivarimer, it's a novel agent that was being studied by a pharmaceutical company as a hydrochloric acid binder. So it was actually binding hydrochloric hydrogen ions and chloride anions in the gut and preventing them from being absorbed. This was a big trial that was recruiting patients probably from 2017 or so onward. The study was called Valor CKD. And unfortunately, it ended early because of financial issues and so forth. Basically, the backdrop of this trial is that it took patients with a GFR around 30, so our patient, with metabolic acidosis. The bicarbonate at enrollment was around 17. And the trial design was pretty interesting. They didn't just straightforwardly randomize Vivarimer and bicarbonate. They actually did an 8-week run-in where every patient got Vivarimer, and the patients that responded, which was about 2/3 of the patients, were then randomized to continue the Vivarimer or to be switched to bicarbonate. And this is part of, I think, the reason why the trial was ended and didn't show a benefit in the end, was that because when you looked at the separation of serum bicarbonate in the two groups, the difference was about 1. It was like 22 in one group and 21 in the other group. And so they were looking at these hard outcomes of GFR decline, dialysis, and transplant. Very hard to show that if your difference in bicarbonate is just 1, regardless of the drug. So I don't think we're ever going to see the drug, which is unfortunate, but I want to give kudos to people like Nav Tangri who actually published negative data despite the trial ending early. You know, in the nephrology world, we knew about the trial ending, I want to say, about a year and a half ago, and there was this, you know, there's no news from the company. I think the company is bankrupt at this point. And the question was, were we ever actually going to see the data? But, you know, it just published about a week ago. So we're able to review it. But the drug, unfortunately, is not going to be coming, although it was looking pretty promising.
The GI side effects had to be brutal, too. Like, I'm just thinking, like, they had to all be iron deficient and, like, having a horrible indigestion.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd have to look at the paper to remind myself if there was a difference in those side effects or not.
So before we wrap up the case with Mrs. T, any other things that you wanted to mention about this, maybe like mistakes, pitfalls that you see in this metabolic acidosis and CKD?
Sure. I would say one of the mistakes or pitfalls that I have seen is that basically we alluded to this before, but just not looking at the trend in bicarbonate and making decisions based on one value, right? So a CKD patient who has a bicarbonate of 21 and is pretty well compensated, if they were to eat burgers for 2 weeks and you recheck their labs, their bicarbonate is probably going to drop to 17 or 18 just from, again, that net acid production. So looking at the trends is really important because just remember, it's a continuous variable. Another big one, and I think Joel mentioned this before in your pod, is that we're making the assumption that a low bicarbonate is metabolic acidosis. In CKD4, I usually make that assumption too. But without getting an ABG, you're really actually not sure what you're dealing with. And so this has come up only a few times more in the inpatient setting, but like sometimes you're dealing with a respiratory alkalosis and your bicarbonate is low because of compensation. As you know, it's hard to get an ABG in a clinic. But if this comes up in the inpatient side, I think it's worth knowing what you're dealing with before you actually start someone on alkali. I think the biggest mistake that I see, this doesn't really pertain to CKD, so apologize if I'm stepping a little bit on the inpatient side, but we kind of talked about it before when we were talking about IV bicarbonate, is I see this a lot of times when a patient has an acidosis and they're on IV bicarbonate and they get switched from a bicarb drip to 650 milligrams BID. And they expect that to have the same effect of alkali when in fact you're giving like about 10 times less. So just remember that you're never going to give as much bicarb in pill form as you're going to be able to give in IV form. So if the acidosis is severe, give IV because it's just easier to give the amount. And when you need to kind of maintain and stabilize, then the pills are the way to go.
So Paul, do you want to read the conclusion of our case? And then I think we're ready to go to take home points then.
Sure. After some discussion, Mrs. T opts to monitor her labs every 3 months. She will incorporate a few servings of fresh fruits and vegetables into her diet each day, and she prefers not to take any additional medications at this time. Jake is also wondering what grade he might actually get for this. He could really use an honors right now. Maybe if he'd have time to write a letter for him, he would really appreciate it too.
Oh, thank God we're in a pass-fail curriculum for Jake.
But Mrs. T's doing great. We'll leave it at that. We fixed her. And as much as you can.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy that after all of this, the big take home is eat your fruits and veggies. I mean, it's kind of what we were told as kids. Yeah. And it's still true. And it's still sometimes hard for me. But like, you know, eat your fruits and veggies. Don't worry about causing hyperkalemia if the patient hasn't had a history of having high potassiums. And you know, I think you're less likely now to be reaching for sodium bicarbonate or baking soda than you were in the past. And if anything, that's a good thing for the patient.
All right. And then, usually we ask people if they have anything like to plug. I was going to suggest we plug people filling out their Neph Madness bracket, but if you had anything else you want to plug,
no, that's great. Let's, Neph Madness. So, go to ajkdblog.org on March 1st. That's when the, event launches. And, basically on that website, you can read about all the topics, this one included in the metabolic acidosis region. That, website will give you a link to go to the website to fill out your bracket and actually play the game. And then you can also follow the hashtag NephMadness on Twitter to keep up with all of the, debate and discussion.
Yeah. This will come out sometime after the brackets have already opened, but, perfect. If you haven't filled them out yet, then you can fill them out. All right.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox, which includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to, you know, the Neph Madness folks for once again inviting us to do this podcast. And to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Manchu moderates our Discord, and Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.